Okay. So at Yaakov's prompting, I'm going to try something new at the beginning of Shir, and I'm going to summarize what we did in the previous Shir. Okay? We do that sometimes, but let's try this. Okay? So, the Gemara says two things that we're focusing on. One is that you're allowed to be memashkein for tzedakah, which means that if someone isn't giving the tzedakah they're supposed to, you're allowed to take security until they pay up. Two is you have a story of Rava forcing someone to give tzedakah. Both of these imply a certain level of coercion for tzedakah. Okay? Problem. Gemara and Chulin Daf Kaf Yud Amud Bet sets out a principle that any mitzvah aseh, any positive mitzvah where the reward is explicitly delineated for that mitzvah next to the mitzvah's description in the Torah, matan sara bitzida, you cannot coerce. Tzedakah, the pasuk tells you that you should give tzedakah val yirah levavcha v'sitcha lo, ki devar hazev, right, because of this thing that you're not going to be, right, hard in your heart, God will reward you, which seems to fit that bill of positive mitzvah reward delineated. How can we force? And we said, methodologically speaking, there are three types of answers that you can offer. Category one of answers are, right, or if we review this again, there's two assumptions, right? Tzedakah, this is coercion, and tzedakah is matan sara b'tzida. So the three types of answers you can do can reject assumption one or assumption two or provide an exception clause. So either you can say this isn't really coercion, or you can say tzedakah really isn't a matan sara b'tzida, right? Or you can say, yes, this is coercion, yes, tzedakah is matan sara b'tzida, and nevertheless, you can coerce in this case. Right? Those are the three types of answers that we can talk about. Okay? Right? Meaning, if you can coerce, you can't coerce from matan mitzvot that have their schar next to them, so either you have to deny that what we're talking about here is coercion, or you can say it is coercion, but we were wrong in our assumption that tzedakah is defined as matan schar avitzida, or you can say both of those are true, and nevertheless, there's an exception to this rule. Okay? We got through four answers out of many possible ones on Thursday, each of which tells us something fundamental about the mitzvah of tzedakah. So we started with answer one in Rabbeinu Tam, which is, this isn't coercion. This is verbal coercion. It's chastisement. It's firm rebuke. You should do this. You are wrong for not giving tzedakah. But you cannot in fact coerce. Okay? We'll come back to Rabbeinu Tam in a minute. That fits in, if we have our three types of answers, imagine a board here, right? So that fits in category one of type of answer, meaning this isn't coercion. Answer two in Rabbeinu Tam was the only reason they could coerce in this case was because the people in this city had accepted coercive measures upon themselves for tzedakah, right? Well, so Rabbeinu Tam makes a localized claim. We'll get there, that in this city they agreed to be coerced. Meaning, this is coercion, and normally you can't coerce on tzedakah, right? The first two assumptions remain intact. But this is an exception to the rule, because you're not coercing because of tzedakah, you're coercing because you agreed to be coerced, and this is just social contract, and that's all there is to it. There's agreement, okay? That was answer two. Yes, Yonatan. We didn't have to say just city. Rabbeinu Tam did say that. Yes, and I said that's what I gave you in the Makara, but that's not Rabbeinu Tam. Because he said that. Because he just didn't want to make a universal claim. He said in this city, they made an agreement. He's not saying that you couldn't somewhere else, he's just saying it's not fundamental. In this city, they did. Then we saw answer three in Tosafot, which was the re, which was, staka, even though it is matan schar b'tzida, you can coerce because it has two negative, right, two prohibitions, negative mitzvah. That's not really what you should say. The English is prohibitions, right? Right? In Hebrew, it's a lo ta'aseh, but in English, that sounds weird, right? The do's and don't do's, right? No, it's called commandments and prohibitions. There are actual words for these things. So the re says that because there are lo ta'aseh involved, So you can coerce. And we said there are two ways of understanding the re. What were the two ways of understanding the re? Yonatan, what were the two ways of understanding the re? Why does having a lav change the picture? Ezra, fine. Ezra was volunteering instead of me volunteering Yonatan. Coercion, as things go. Yes? Correct, right? Either what he's saying is that you're not coercing the asev stuck at all. You're coercing to prevent the violation of the prohibitions. Or he's saying that, no, the combination of asev plus loz asev makes a super lav. Super asev lav, whatever. Which has nafkmin in other areas of halacha. I don't want to get into them, but there are places in which you actually see this. Okay? Fine, that was answer three we addressed. Answer four we dealt with was Gavi's answer, which was Mechavin Ter Luchumstein, which is, no. If you read the psukim carefully, Daka, meaning giving money to poor people, doesn't have a reward next to it in the Torah. It's the end of the pasuk. It's don't begrudge him when you give it. It's the emotional component of the mitzvah of staka for which you get the reward. And therefore, it could be that staka itself is not matan schar betzida. It doesn't get reward. It gets reward. It doesn't have a reward next to it. The reward is for the emotional component, but you're not forcing for the emotional component. I don't care about the emotional component. I just want you to give the money. Right? And that is coercible. Those are the four answers that we had seen on Thursday. Now, before we move on to answer five, I want to point out that there is a problem with Rabbeinu Tam, which we didn't get a chance to discuss on Thursday, and that is, there are two lines in the Gemara that Rabbeinu Tam has to explain, right? Remember, again, reminder, answer one Rabbeinu Tam is that he coerced him, not violently, right? He didn't beat him, verbally. What's the problem? Is that there are two lines in the Gemara. The second one, that makes sense. Akve, so maybe you can say that's coercion. What's the problem with the first line? Remember, there are two lines that Rabbeinu Tam has answered. The first one was memaskinin, was that we take security on your property. Now, it's one thing to say that verbal rebuke doesn't count as coercion. It's another thing to say that confiscation of property is not coercive. Right? Yes. Yeah, thank you. So Rabbeinu Tam seems a little bit weird. Right? Because, again, it's one thing to say that when Rava coerced him, it meant rebuke. Okay, fine. That I can sort of buy. It's weird linguistically, but fine. But really? You're going to tell me that confiscation of property is not coercive? No, but we did mimashkinin, right? Yeah, I mean, sure, we will, but we'll never actually do it. We'll just tell you we're going to do it, right? No, that's not how things work. That's a fun difference to you, which also comes up in our Gemara, but I chose to skip, but maybe I'll come back to it, which is, can we lie? Can we lie about what the psak is in order to unwittingly coerce you to do the right thing? It's a fascinating thing, yeah. I gave this last year, I think, or maybe 2 years ago. It was such a fun share to give. I gave it as a dry run in Efrat to like a bunch of people who have like smicha, and they were all yelling at me by the end of it. I'm like, stop, Pete, the Gemara. Like, I don't know what you want from me. When you say what? Okay, so, right, so this is what, to defend Rabbeinu Tam, we can go in two directions. We can either say, no, really, he doesn't believe that taking someone's money is coercive, either because what Rami's saying is, look, taking somebody's money is still not as bad as beating them, okay, or what Ezra had said to defend Rabbeinu Tam, which was, coercion has to be something which is not reversible, right? Ezra's claim was, no, confiscating a property, I mean, it's coercive, but it's not coercive in the same way, because you can undo it. If the guy decides to give the money, you'll give him back the property and no harm done. Yeah, and I'll end up giving the equivalent and whatever it is. Not every bought this. So I'll give you the other answers and you can tell me whether you like them or not. The Shittim of Kubeset quotes a position that what Yehonatan said in jest is in fact pshat. which is they didn't take his property. They took his property verbally. They said they were going to take his property. It meant that everything here is just verbal. Now, that is a very weird answer, admittedly. I mean, Yohanan done said in jest. The Shittim HaGumeset says it seriously. It doesn't make it any less weird. So that is possible. What? I mean, sure, it solves the problem. What? Yeah, I mean, he just, you know, yes, exactly. Yeah. So the it's problematic as things go, but fine. Another possibility is one of these achronim in the back, you know, in the tiny little print, Rav Simcha of I don't even know how to pronounce it. Do you see or something? He suggests that. You're right. You're not even allowed to confiscate money. And that was a very unique case. That was a case of pikuach nefesh. When there's pikuach nefesh, then you can take the property. He just comes up with a new kimta, right? He says, you're right. Under normal circumstances, taking property is considered coercive. It must be that that's an exception to all rules. Now, I don't understand that, because if that was true, then you could have said the same thing. Maybe you're allowed to coerce someone to do a mitzvah to say matzah and karbetzi. That wouldn't be pikuach nefesh. Like once you say once you throw pikuach nefesh into the mix, it's like, yeah, you know, I find it very odd. It is. Look, it's hard. I don't know what to tell you. It is. It's difficult. Okay. Now, before we move on from Inutam, I want to take a step back, and I want to ask you even the bigger question, which is, right now all we've been doing is outlining the answers. But let me push you farther conceptually now. We've seen that according to Rabbi Inutam, he seems very insistent on the fact that by the time we get to the end of this sugya, staka cannot be coerced. Right? Rabbi Inutam has two answers. Both of them want to conclude that staka can't be coerced. Right?
Like regular staka.
Right, because he says that you're not coercing staka, you're coercing people to keep their agreements. But staka, quad staka, he's very insistent that you cannot coerce it. The mitzvah of staka, qua the mitzvah of staka, he thinks is not cannot be coerced. For other reasons, maybe. As opposed to already that we've seen, the re says, no, that's not true. The maskana is you can coerce staka. If I had to ask you before you even knew the rule of matan skara bitzida, right, before you knew this rule, if I asked you, right, which I'm going to be mean, but you will forgive me. I would say this is a theoretical, but how about the following? Imagine it is Wednesday last week before I introduced you to the rule you had never heard of, matan skara bitzida. Okay? I hope you're not all insulted, but I'm going to take a wild guess that you didn't know that rule. Did you? Anyone? Okay, good. So imagine it's Wednesday, and I have not yet introduced you to the Gemara and Chulin, because you all hadn't read Chulin yet. So you didn't know there was such a rule of matan skara bitzida. And I asked you in a vacuum, do you think it makes sense to coerce someone to give staka? So now this is the a priori question. Right before you knew the Gemara. So now, tell me why or why not, and then I want you to tell me what that tells me about the mitzvah of staka. So Yaakov, I saw him nodding his head vigorously, even though he hasn't raised his hand, but I'm going to make you defend your, oh, you default. No, I can't handle this. Yeah. Good. Defend it. Go ahead. Defend. Defend why you think you don't like the idea of coercion. And don't just tell me I don't like the idea of coercion ever. That's fine. But I want, within a framework that it believes in some sort of coercion, Why not stuck up? Oh, thank you. Thank you. Good. Okay, before I went it, Ellie, first time in a year. Yes, Ellie. I know it's disconcerting that he's taking a picture of you. But yell. Isn't that? Okay, what's the problem with that? Why not? Yes? Okay, good. Okay, good. So, okay, Yonatan and Ezra, and then we'll take them play. Go. Oh, good. Oh, thank you. Thank you for bringing up the language I wanted. Very good. Ezra. Oh, good. We got four different answers here. Okay, good. So, we have Yonatan who says, Rami, you want to weigh in also? Good. I have everybody weighing in. I'm missing Andrew, but otherwise, go. Fine, admittedly. I agree. Okay, good. So
we want someone to give to write it again because they're the board of them.
Okay, no, I don't want to get into that question. I'm not getting to that question now. I'm not getting to that question. You're right, but I'm not getting to that question. No, I'm not getting to that question now. I know that there are some times where we call it where we say it's not really coercion, even though it is. Yes, I know by a get, we beat the guy into an inch of his life and say, but we're doing this of your own free will, because really you want to do the right thing, because deep down everyone wants to do the right thing, and even if the only reason you're doing it is because you're beating him to death, still, I know, I'm aware that the Rambam says that, and that Rambam, I may believe in that Rambam, but I will just say, first of all, it's not our topic, it's a fascinating topic. Second of all, that Rambam got a lot of bad press a few years ago in New York. It was really, really bad, right? When a few rabbis took the law into their own hands and were a little bit too trigger happy on the way they endorsed it. It was worse than that. It was, I can't even turn off the recorder. I don't know how to do that on my phone. On the app. But there was an FBI case of a group of rabbis who were very zealous in forcing people to give gets to their wives who wouldn't. And they were not averse to using electrocution on parts of your body you probably don't want to be electrocuted on to coerce people to give gets to their wives. Not a wonderful thing, but this made it to the news in New York a few years ago. It was a very interesting court case. Anyways, yeah, he even made it to, there was even a Law and Order show years ago about a woman in the Bukharan community who hired a hitman to kill her husband to deal with the Aguna case. It's something that gets talked about a lot in New York, but I really don't want to talk about it so much. Yeah, it was really, now you're looking it up. You're like, really? This happened? Yes. Yes, it did. They used electric cattle prods to, electric cattle prods to prod husbands to give their wives gittin. And then the FBI set up a sting. It was very, very interesting. Anyways, fine. So I'm going to pick up on what Yonatan said and say the following. And then I will try to frame everyone. Yehonadan brings us into the conversation of what are the ethical theories that drive the nature of mitzvah or define them. And Yonatan notes that there are different theories of ethics in this world, right? there is what Yehonatan picked up on, which is called consequentialist ethics. What are consequentialist ethics, since you invoked it? Yehonatan, what are... Yes, I know. I didn't spare details on this. Yes, Yehonatan, what are consequentialist ethics? Correct. Yehonatan says that that one theory of ethics means the results matter. The most famous consequentialist theory of ethics is utilitarianism, right? Meaning consequentialist ethics means the results, right? That ethics are defined by the results. Utilitarianism means that they're defined by the amount of happiness in the world, right? Okay, but utilitarianism is just a subset of consequentialism. That's not utilitarian. That's something different, right? You can say that you should make decisions based on what will make people happy, but what matters is your intent. That's not a consequentialist theory, right? Okay. One of the major moral critiques of consequentialism is what's called the moral luck argument, right? The moral lucky, right? Because a strict read of consequentialism means that if I intend to do the right thing and it turns out bad, my act was immoral. And if I intended to do something bad and it turned out good, right? It's like, you know, a mobster says that they want to, right? They want to force someone to pay the loan. So they amputate a limb, right? And it turns out that limb had a dangerous cancer growing in it or whatever. The person had gangrene and the doctor had called for amputation of their foot, and it turns out the mobster saved their life. The mobster is now a good person in the consequentialist rule book, right? As opposed to the person who, right, the doctor who tries to save someone's life and ends up killing them because the procedure is not successful, that is an immoral act, right? That's one of the moral critiques that's been raised of pure consequentialism is moral luck. There are responses to the moral luck argument, but okay. Yes, Ezra.
Also, you can just invoke like the butterfly effect. You can say, like, oh, you can't tell whatever I'm doing if it's good or bad, so you can do whatever you want.
Correct. Right, that's one of the problems with consequentialism is the good place problem with consequentialism. Have you watched The Good Place at all?
I watched it.
Right, so I was told by another educator to watch the Good Place, but it's basically a four season comedy show which explores the basic fundamental questions about ethics throughout the entire season. That's all the seasons. That's what the series does, right? What? What? No. Okay. Anyways, but they do a good job of this, right? With the butterfly effect problem. Yeah. But that's one theory of ethics. Another theory of ethics is virtue ethics. What's virtue ethics? No, we'll get to Kant in a second. Virtue ethics is Aristotle, and in Jewish thought, most championed by the Rambam, right? Which is that the point of mitzvah, the point of ethical act, is to make you an ethical person, right? Is to change the person, right? To make you virtuous, right? Then there's the Kantian approach,
which is it's all about what your intentions are.
Right, it's not about making you a good person. It's about doing the right thing. Correct, but it's not about virtue, right? Virtue is about making you a good person. For Kant, it's about doing the right thing, right? You must do the right thing, always. You must do the right thing. Yeah, well, oh, that's a separate question. How you, right, no. Kant believes that what is the right thing is that which is self-legislated, right? Autonomy, which has become an obsession in Western thought, is because of Kant, because he believes that the way you figure out what's moral is through the categorical imperative, right? That you figure out if the whole world would do this act, would it lead to good consequences? If it will, then it must be a moral act, right? If bad, etc. And therefore, you must then follow that act under all circumstances. So if the world can't survive people lying, then even if a murderer comes and says, where is your son? You cannot lie to them because lying is bad. You must tell them where your son is because telling the truth is a good thing, right? There are attempts to make him make more sense in that extreme formulation. Course Guard is one of the most careful Kantian, what? I mean, he didn't actually weigh in on the trolley problem.
Yeah.
But when I taught the trolley problem from Halacha at Amudim, I just showed them the scene from The Good Place on this, which is a machlokes between consequentialism and Harris wrote an article in the Torah Mada Journal on this question of what does the case of the trolley problem and Halacha's treatment of it in Sheva Ben Bichri case teach us about deontological ethics, virtue ethics versus consequentialist ethics. It's a fascinating topic. Now, one second, Ezra. The point being as follows, I wasn't just taking on a brief excursus on the theory of ethics, as much as I enjoy doing that, I really do enjoy doing that, but the reason is as follows. Halacha is probably not purely one or the other, probably not. Okay, probably. There are good indications in halacha that, you know, halacha isn't... Look, any sane person... Philosophers have this thing about being more consistent than might be sane, right? But normal people have a vague notion that all these things somewhat matter, right? Halacha sort of has that common sense approach to it. But certain mitzvot are definitely more one than the other. So now we come back to you. So Yehonadan says, if you had asked him in a vacuum, he would have said that staka should be coerced because if you think that staka is a consequentialist mitzvah, whatever all other mitzvot are, but the point of staka is primarily to help the poor person. So when it comes to consequentialist ethics, coercion makes a lot more sense because what matters is the result. And therefore, I care less about your intent. I care less about purity of motive in, as Yaakov correctly notes, some deontologists, right? I just don't care so much. I care that the poor people get the money that they need. They're not starving. They're in the street. And if that's the case, then staka of all mitzvot, it makes sense to coerce. That's Yonatan's claim. More sophisticated version and spell that. Okay? But yes, that is what you said, right? Eli said, no. I think that staka is a virtue-based, I'm now getting formal philosophical language to Eli's, but, okay, Eli said this in non-philosophical language, but, right, which was, no, staka is because I want you to do the right thing. I want you to be a good person. I want you to be a giving person. That doesn't work if I hold a gun to your head and make you give it. Right. So Ellie argues that there may be other mitzvot that are there to take care of the poor in a consequentialist one. Like staka seems to be a mitzvah where the focus is virtue, right? Is about making sure that you are a good person, right? That you are a giving person. We can't coerce you into being a, we can coerce you to give. We can't coerce you to be a giving person. Whoa. Now, you can split the difference, right? How can you split the difference?
Saying the outward act matters only if for the qualifications you need other kinds of intent to make that matter.
Well, okay, let me try this again. According to Yehonatan, before the mitzvah of Matan Schar V'Tzidah, he would have assumed you could coerce. Ellie would have said, before I knew about the mitzvah, the Matan Schar V'Tzidah issue, I would say don't coerce because you can't coerce someone to be a good person. And I'll read you the Maharal, which basically goes in Ellie's direction. The Maharal says, Ki ma shechiva ha-Torah b'staka u-maser, why the Torah command maser and staka, shekein ha-adam b'sad shu adam chayav shizim maser, kidei shiye nefesh adam tov, v'lo yiye nefesh ra. Because God commanded staka so that you will be a good person. You will be a giving person and not a bad person, not a stingy person. Right? And if that's the case, coercion doesn't help you to that end. Or as Rav Kook suggests, Rav Kook writes, Tachlit Hatzdaka Hu Bishna. What? Now, I'll read it actually Rav Kook in a second. Now, before Ezra weighs in, how could you split the difference? Before you get to that, something we already saw, we didn't see the resolve edge yet. Who was Gavi's formulation from Rav Lichtenstein, which was Tzaka isn't matan schar b'tzida, but right, what's matan schar b'tzida? Not giving it begrudgingly, and therefore the giving of the money is consequentialist, and you can coerce. But the emotional component, which is a separate value within tzaka, cannot be coerced. So maybe tzaka actually has both, right? That was right. Essentially, the compromise that Gavi and Rochenstein came to is that you can coerce the giving, but the emotional thing that you should give not begrudgingly. Obviously, you've given begrudgingly if someone held a gun to your head and then you gave it. That is the definition that you can't coerce. Let me just read you a piece by Rav Kook, who has this Sveidinim approach, and then we'll go back to Yaakov and Ezra's formulations. One second. Rav Kook writes, Tachlit Hatzdaka Hu Bishnayim. There are two purposes to tzedaka. Echad hu lihyot lahoil la'ani. Point one is to help the poor. Hasheni, husha noten yotzi me'akoch la'pol, midat ha'tov, la'asot tov. The second is to help the giver manifest his, I don't know what you're doing, to help his internal goodness manifest itself in goodness in the world, right? To go from potential to actual. The chesed and kindness of Azeu Mashlim Nafsho, thereby perfecting his personality. And he thinks that that's the priority, which would lead you to say you can't coerce. Okay, now let's come back. Yaakov and Ezra, now let's fit in your formulations. We're slightly different nuances than Yehonatan and Eli, which were on opposite sides of the spectrum. Go. One more time. What did you say, Yaakov? What did you say, right? You didn't want to coerce. Why didn't you want to coerce?
Oh, because
that's the Matan Skar B'tzida point. Okay, now we forgot his nuance. That's fine. Okay. It was somewhere close to Ellie's, but yeah, Ezra, and then Ezra, what was your middle? You had a formulation that was not as extreme as either. No, your own.
I mean, there's like some things like, I mean, there are some things like the
conflict. Okay, good, right? So, wait, okay. So now we're moving, but this is, if I asked you a priori, right, what you would have said, this is what we would have said. But what we'll see is that there are ways of splitting the difference. Right now, one way of splitting the difference is Rav Lichtenstein's way, which is to say the mitzvah of giving tzedakah is consequentialist and therefore can be coerced. But there's also an emotional component that's supposed to make you a good person. They don't get begrudging. So in a chanami, the emotional part you can't coerce. Yes, Yonatan.
Are you saying would be coercion, like should be coercion?
It would have no bearing on the emotional part of the mitzvah. Correct. It just is what it is. Correct. Okay. So, fine. Now, which Rishon very clearly took the extreme of the consequentialist one? Now let's introduce a new Shita that we haven't seen yet. Who very much went in, who thinks that this whole sugya hangs on this question of consequentialist versus non-consequentialist ethics in the case of tzedaka? No, who really, really says this very explicitly? The Ritva. You know the second Ritva you looked at in Ktuvos? Okay, let me read a line that you should have read during Seder, and you tell me if he answers it very clearly. In a case where we know how much money you should give, we coerce you. Perish me din staka. Even though it is a mitzvah that has its reward next to it, meaning it shouldn't be coerced. The kaimalon, the chol mitzvah asay shematan schara bitzida ein bezdin muzharin aleha. And we said that you normally can't coerce for this. Hatam hu bishar mitzvot kegon kibud avayin chayotibazet. Those are like other mitzvot, like honoring your parents. Aval inyan staka kaifinan, but by staka you coerce. Mipnei machsoram shel aniyim, because of the lack of the poor people. Hence the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah that he's now bringing in, which I didn't make you read, but, and you should do it. From here you learn that Bezdin should force it. The given that's really by Nidarim and not by Tztaka. Gali Rachmana Bitztaka Shahotzi Befiv. The fact that you can coerce someone to keep their promise by tzedaka shows that tzedaka is the type of thing you coerce, because tzedaka is a mitzvah that's primarily about making sure the poor people have money. So, the Ritva, now this is our answer 5, says, can you coerce by tzedaka? Yes. Is it matan schar b'tzida? Yes. So he goes and answers in category 3 and says, it is an exception to the rule. Why is it an exception to the rule? Because it's a consequentialist mitzvah. And when we say matan schara bitzida, I want to put it in very careful philosophical language. He has a very fascinating theory, which is virtue-based mitzvot, or deontological-based mitzvot, where what matters is what type of person you are, or whether you intend to do the right thing. So there, it makes sense to say that if matan schara bitzida, then I won't coerce. You don't want to be a good person? That's your problem. You don't want to do the right thing? That's your problem. But in a mitzvah which is fundamentally consequentialist, right, which cares about the results, so there you're going to coerce no matter what. Whether there's reward, not reward, who cares? Consequentialist mitzvot get coercion because what matters is the result. Right, and therefore the Ritva says very clearly that he's willing to break all rules here, because any limitation that you see only makes sense with virtue-based or deontological-based mitzvot, or whatever you want to say, divine command. We can go into other ethical theories, but not consequentialist-based mitzvot. Consequentialist-based mitzvot, what I care about is the consequences. I don't care how I get there, right? If I have to hold a gun to your head for you to give the tzedakah, then I will hold a gun to your head. If I have to beat you within an inch of your life, fine. If I have to use an electric cattle prod, then I will use an electric cattle prod. Right? However creative. I'm not saying we should actually be doing that. I'm just saying in theory. Right? Yes. But they did are famously creative about how they coerce. Right? I'm not endorsing that. I remember Rabbi Willig telling this. He's like, I'm not endorsing this. Right? I'm just, you know. Right? Meaning, in Europe, it was famous. How did they coerce people to give gittin? This was like apparently a standard way they did this in Europe. No. They would kidnap the husband in the middle of the night, bring him to a graveyard over an open grave, and they would say, the first Mishnah in Kiddushin says that there's two ways for a woman to be released from a marriage, a get or death, you choose. Right? That was the traditional way of doing it. In modern times, we don't do this. Right? You know, there are all types of creative ways. I know that Rabbi Brander, when he was rabbi in Florida, apparently once had a husband who refused to give a get. So he didn't have coercive powers, obviously. So he did the next best thing, and he closed the only mikvah in town and put a sign on it and said, mikvah closed, right? Which means that anybody whose wife needs to go to the mikvah, right? They can't be intimate until they go to the mikvah. Mikvah closed until person X gives a get to his wife, right? And let the forces in society deal with it. As I heard the story, it took one day, but you know, whatever, right? There are creative ways of doing it within the bounds of the law, In Israel, we just throw them in jail. In Israel, they didn't have coercive powers. So we take away their passport, we throw them in jail, right? Yeah, well, there are people who've been sitting in jail for years out of spite. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, Ezra. What? Okay, so good. Ezra is saying, well, maybe even there, you have to attenuate this a little bit and say, you're right, if it was purely consequentialist, then I would just take it from you and I wouldn't bother coercing you, right? The fact that I coerce you indicates that there is some element of virtue or deontology, at least, right, where I want you to do the right thing. You're right. I think you're right, right? And this is... It's primarily consequentialist, and therefore we force you, but you're right. Meaning, now, Mamashkin is not like that. When I take your money and, right, take your property until you give it, right, ironically, that's much, much more consequentialist. It's just saying, look, I'm going to hold on to the money until you pay up, right? Correct. And this, okay, fine. I said I wasn't going to do it, but Ezra brought it up and Rami brought it up, so fine. Apparently now there are two votes against me, so now I'm overwhelmed. Now I'll bring it up. Yes, at some level, right, halacha does believe, right, the Rambam has this, right, okay. Halacha has this bizarre model, which is called kofin oto ata yomer rotzani. We coerce you until you say, I want to, right, which the Rambam says that the reason you do that is because he says in the context of gittin, where you need to give a get of your own free will. And he says, well, how can you call it your free will if you beat the guy until he gave the get? And he says, because everybody really wants to do the right thing. But their yetzer hara stops them from doing the right thing. So if we beat you, we weaken your, we basically weaken the resolve of your yetzer hara, and the true you comes out, the one who wants to do what the rabbis say is the halacha. So, so there... Yeah, that wouldn't work, because that would be called, right, that wouldn't call it his own free will. Right, so that gets complicated because we, in general, assume that external coercion vitiates the responsibility of the person. In a way, internal coercion does not, right? So, right, I mean, look, you know, again, this is a bit more complicated, but for example, the Rambam paskins in Parakei Halacha Dalet of Hilchei Yesodei Torah that if someone coerces you, coerces Reuven to commit Avodah Zarah, to worship Avodah Zarah, he's not allowed to worship Avodah Zarah. It's one of the big three. But if he does it, he's patur because it was Anos. It wasn't him. But in Halacha Vav, the Rambam says, but if someone is dying of a disease, and the only way that he can save himself is by partaking of Avodah Zarah, right, Avodah Zarah Karban or something, I don't know, then he's Chayav. And the Rav is a very long piece where he analyzes and he says, because in the end of the day, external coercion we view as not an expression of your own free will, because you've basically, the decision-making process has been, meaning it's been outsourced, right? And even though you made the choice to give in out of fear, still it was someone else calling the shots. But when that's internal, even though you're under coercion, right, you're even under pressure, right? You're dying, God forbid, Reuven is dying, a theoretical person. The fact that in the end there's no external person who made that decision, he made that calculus, the cost-benefit analysis, right, rather than someone else, it's considered his free will. So it is a little bit complicated here. But I think Ezra's right that at some level, what you've got to say is the fact that halacha would rather coerce the guy until he gives staka rather than just take the money from him says it may be primarily consequentialist, right? But we still want you to perform the act, right? The mitzvah, either because we think that it'll help your virtue at some level, right? Giving, even under coercion, will start the process of making you a better person, or because of the Kantian thing, not the extreme Kantian thing where, yes, you need purity of motive, which this is not, but simply that the value of ethics is doing the right act, rather that is intrinsically meaningful. So Rav Lochamtzin is a compromise between this, right, where it says the giving of the money is consequentialist, but there's also a virtue or deontological approach here, the emotional one, which we can't coerce at all, we can't affect. You do it of your own free will, then you get rewarded. If not, not. Well, yes, it's a very neat answer. I didn't say it wasn't. Okay, so those are, that's five answers so far. Five answers, yes? Okay, but it's a reframing of some of the answers we've already seen. And a fifth answer. Okay. However, right, there is the answer that Yehonatan is partial to, and Eli was partial to, which was Rabbeinu Tam answer two didn't go far enough. Right, Rabbeinu Tam answer two says, look, staka you can't coerce, but if you happen to choose to live in a city where they agree to be coerced, so then you can be coerced. Yehonatan and Eli in different ways said, wait, I got a better answer for you, which is, staka is not cannot be coerced, because staka is a mitzvah, let's say, virtue. It's about you being a giving person, right? But there's social welfare taxes. Taxes are meant to be coercive, because taxes, and there are things that look like staka, as we've said 100 times, but are not staka. They are social welfare taxes, right? They may accomplish the same goal, but they are not the same thing. And maybe staka, i.e. the mitzvah of charity, is not coercible, but taking care of the poor through social welfare, which is taxes, which is consequentialist, because, you know, taxes are, right, society and the functioning of budgets are consequentialist, right? Nobody should look at a politician and say, he meant well, it's not his fault that he's bureaucratically incompetent, right, and wasted funds. We don't say that, right? They shouldn't do that, right? We hold government officials not just to good intentions, right? Now, yes, we won't put it this way. If it turns out that someone was just incompetent, so we may not try them and arrest them, right, for embezzling of funds. But we probably should not vote them back into office.
No, I learned that.
I didn't say we don't vote them back into office. I said you shouldn't vote them back into office. Okay? People who are incompetent at what they do should not be voted back into office. Right? Yes. Again, we know that they will. You know, Hinami. What can you do? Fine. But Yehonatan and Eli both say Rabbeinu Tam didn't go far enough. Rabbeinu Tam is imagining that the consequentialist thing can be chosen, but this is not a systematic claim. But there's a much neater way to go about this, and that is to say, no. Staka, maybe the mitzvah, that thing we call staka, charity, is about goodwill, is about doing the right thing. That's why we have other mechanisms in halacha, right? Mechanisms like taxes, mechanisms like the kupa and tamchoi, which are social welfare, right? Which are publicly funded soup kitchens that make sure that even if people aren't nice, right? This is, right, again, this is often the machloket between people on the right and people on the left. People on the right will say, we want to help the poor, but it should be left in the hands of charities, of churches and synagogues and whatever, right? Lower taxes and people will be good and will pay more money to charity, right? Which is true of many people on the right. Not everybody, obviously, but true of many people on the right, right? Okay? So like when Mitt Romney said that, Mitt Romney meant it. And you look at how the percentage of his taxes that he pays to charity every year, he puts his money where his mouth is, right? There are people like that. Okay, and then there are people on the left who will say, look, we think that the poor should be taken care of, but if you leave it to people's goodwill, those selfish, egotistical, megalomaniacal capitalist billionaires will not give up their money, right? Blah, 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 whatever, right? We can talk about both sides. Fine. Now, yes, obviously there are people on the right who say, I want lower taxes and then take the money to buy an extra yacht. In Achinami, there are such people, okay? Right? There are bad people on both sides. We got that, right? But you could just say, look, charity is about giving money, right? Charity is about giving money. Actually, you know what? I'm sorry. Before I say the ktos, let me just, I should have said this. Ezra's point on the Ritva is spot on, right? The Ritva in Ktubot that I just read you is the one who says that Staka is purely consequentialist. But the Ritva in Rosh Hashanah that I gave you is much clearer that what he actually believes is what Ezra believes, right? Which is that Staka is mostly consequentialist, but the reason that we do it by coercion rather than pure taking of your money is because of the mitzvah component, right? That's clearly what you meant. So you read the Gemara, the Ritva in Rosh Hashanah, and therefore you were, what? Fine. So I gave you the Ritva in Rosh Hashanah. Let me reread it to you, and you'll see how what he was saying was really what Ezra said. So Ezra can very proudly, see, I will just, in parentheses, Ezra, I'm going to give you the option here, okay? You can either take credit that you are an excellent reader and say that you said what you said because you read the Ritva right, or you can say, I'm a good thinker, and therefore I didn't understand what the Ritva was saying, I got it right because I'm a good thinker. Clearly, you're either a good reader or a good thinker, right? You can claim, whichever one gives you, whichever one, no, it's one or the other. Whichever one makes you feel prouder of yourself, you can take the mantle too. I won't make any claims. You can do whichever one you want. But the Ritva in Rosh Hashanah, I'll read it, says as follows. Right, he quotes here as follows. He says, "Lav mishum de mitzvah de ramya alei bilichud kaifin alei." It's not only because of the mitzvah that is on his shoulders that we coerce it, ella mipnei shechiyev atzmeh chazav lagavol laaniyim, but because he committed the money. Right, he said there's two things, right? He's saying this in a slightly different context, right? He's actually quoting the Ritva, right? But he says it's not the mitzvah alone, right? It's dot dot dot. We'll come back to the Ritva, but we already see in the Ritva is the Ritva recognizes that we're not dealing with all or nothing. What we're dealing with is mostly, right? And we'll come back to his qualification, which is from the Ritzba, but we haven't done the Ritzba yet, okay? Fine. But who says the position I attributed now to Yehonatan and Eli, which is Staka is about goodwill, but there's something else called taxes. And Or Shoga isn't about Staka, as we've seen 100 times. It's not about pure Staka, it's about social welfare tax. And therefore, by taxes, we can coerce. Because as Eli put it very nicely, the reason why you might say that staka is not coercible is because if you care about the consequences, Torah is a more complicated system. There are other things that will ensure that the poor are taken care of. And therefore, we can comfortably say that staka is a non-coercive endeavor because we know that the poor won't be starving in the street because there are coercive elements that are consequentialist. It's just not what we call staka, right? And again, this isn't Rabbeinu Tam's very localized claim that it's only in a city where you happen to agree. No. It's our sugya is dealing with such cases. So who says that? To whom were Eli and Yehonatan Mechavein? Or Gam V'Gam, but sure. At some level, they're similar in this sense, but let's start with the Ktos. So who is the Ktot HaChoshen? So, what? You knew I was going to ask a biography. Come on. Rav Arya Leib. Thank you. Rav Arya Leib Heller. He's one of the two main commentaries on what Sefer? Very good. So Choshen Mishpat. On Choshen Mishpat, we have two very important commentaries besides the normal ones. We have the Nesivot HaMishpat, or the Nesivis, as you'll hear in Yeshivish, the Nesivis, right? The Nesivis, right? The Nesivot HaMishpat by Rav Yaakov Ben Yaakov. Don't ask me why. Rav Yaakov Ben Yaakov Leuberbaum. Yes, Yaakov Ben Yaakov Leuberbaum. And the Ketor HaChoshen, Rav Arya Leib Heller. Okay? So, one thing you should know about the Ketot. Okay, this is something you should know about the Ketot. Rav Zvulun Harlov, who for many years was the dean of REITs, of the YU Smicha program, said that good lamdanim are like power hitters in baseball. If they're good, they only have to get it right 1 in 3. And if they're really good, they only have to get it right 1 in 4. Now, certain lamdanim, everything they say is brilliant. It's just that it's either brilliant, obviously correct, or that is so creative, but no one else agrees to it because it is
really,
right? It's a home run distance-wise, but might have gone over the foul line, right? So the Ketot is, I'm not saying he only gets it right 1 in 4, God forbid, right? But the Ketot is the type of writer that everything he writes is super brilliant, and either what you read it, and by the end you're like, that was brilliant and so obviously correct. But sometimes they'll be like, oh yeah, there's shlichut to dead people. And then, to quote Rav Lichtenstein, in kol hakavod laketzot lasvara shelo hu lo tzodek. Right? Like, everything he says is brilliant. Sometimes it's obviously right, sometimes it's obviously wrong. But he's very creative. Everything is very creative. He's a very, very creative thinker. The Nesivos is not like that. The Nesivos, in my experience, and I can't say I've read every Ketot Nesivos, the Nesivos, almost every time I read the Nesivos, I'm like, that is very, that's clever and makes sense. I'm usually not blown away, but I almost always think he's right. Right? That is my personal experience with the Nesivos. No. Okay, I'm going to restate. The Ketot says it slightly differently. No, you're right, Ezra. Right, the clearest formulation of this, if I want to go on the clearest formulation, is Reis Halevichik. Right? Right, let's make this simple, okay? And we'll come back to the Ketot, I guess, tomorrow. The Ketot and the Ritzbah, which he somehow didn't do. But the Ketot is very clear, okay? Reis Halevichik was very clear. The Ketot, we'll see, is a little bit more complicated than what I just said. So, right? The clearest formulation of this, you're right, is just the piece I sent you in Reis Halevichik from the Halachic Positions of Reis Halevichik, Volume 2, where he just says, right, in Talmudic days, the Beit Din of a Jewish community had the authority to enforce compliance of mitzvot. The Gemara relates an incident that Rava once coerced Rav Natan Bar Ami to contribute 400 zuz to tzedakah. Tosfot questions the propriety of this action. Tosfot quote the rule that the Beit Din does not enforce compliance of mitzvot for which the Torah specifies a reward. Regarding the mitzvah of tzedakah, the Torah states, in return for this matter, i.e. giving tzedakah, Hashem will bless you in all your deeds and every undertaking. So how was the Beit Din of Rava able to force Rav Natan to contribute to charity? According to Rav Soloveitchik, there are two aspects of giving tzedakah. There's an individual requirement as well as the communal responsibility. the Rav doesn't say that this is just taxes. The Rav actually goes much more in Eli's direction, which is Staka itself has different... Eli's very happy that he has become the Rav personified in this year. What? I remember once that on my interview for one of, when I was in 12th grade, my interview for one of the yeshivas, not the one I ended up going to, not my Gush interview, my interview for another yeshiva, the interviewer made me read a Tosfot, and then he very bluntly stopped me, and he's like, what do you think Tosfot means? What's the Svara? So I gave him a Svara, and he's like, I don't think that's right. But Rabbi Soloveitchik thought you were right. And I was like, I really could do worse than having been mechavin to the Rav. I'll be honest, I really could do worse. So Eli is mechavin very much to the Rav. Right, what the Rav said is very simple. There's the personal mitzvah tzedakah, where it's not coercive, right? Because it's about making you a good person, it's about whatever it is. But there are other things, the communal obligations. Now, you could put this in two ways, right? One is to just say it's taxes. But what the Rav adds, and this is probably correct, is that the taxes of the community are not mitzvah or morally neutral. That's also part of the mitzvah, right? And therefore, the Rav actually says there's two tzvei dinim, right? There's two aspects of the mitzvah of tzedakah itself. There's the personal mitzvah of tzedakah, which is non-consequentialist, and then there's the communal mitzvah of tzedakah, which is consequentialist. Now, you could have said that no, there's tzedakah and there's communal taxes, and taxes are coercible, and the mitzvah of tzedakah is not coercible. I'm not sure how different that is than the Rav is saying, because obviously the fact that a Jewish society has social welfare tax is not morally neutral. It clearly has some mitzvah component. So I think the Rav is probably the clearest way of saying what Eli said. Okay? That will split the difference. There's some type of tzedakah which is coercible because it's consequentialist, the communal one, but the personal mitzvah tzedakah is not. It's virtue, it's deontological, it's whatever it is. And that is captured by the Matan Schar B'Tzida aspect of the mitzvah, which doesn't exist by the tzibur. Yes, Yonatan. What? So, this is, I think, a way of expanding Rabbeinu Tam. Right? Meaning, right, so coming back to Rabbeinu Tam, I think that Rabbeinu Tam could have gone farther and said that, no, it's not that in this particular case, the people in the city agreed to be coerced. It's that the communal mitzvah is always, in every case, not about virtue, not about, and therefore it's coercible. Yes. Meaning, how is it different? It's not different. It's just that Rabbeinu Tam himself didn't expand it. But you're right. When I pushed you on Rabbeinu Tam and I said, why don't you expand Rabbeinu Tam? I wasn't saying, I think Rabbeinu Tam believes this. He clearly doesn't. Right? For whatever reason. Maybe he thinks that there is no such thing. Right? But you're right. This, what I am now endorsing from the Rav is what I suggested is what Rabbeinu Tam should have said in second answer. Well, Rav Lichtenstein distinguishes between the money and the emotional the emotional part of the mitzvah and the monetary part of the mitzvah. The Rav distinguishes between the individual mitzvah and the communal mitzvah. So Rav Lichtenstein argues that even in the individual mitzvah, the giving of the money is result-oriented, it can be coerced, the emotional component is not coerced. The Rav just said, no, tzedakah of the individual is coercible. Communal tzedakah is not. And I like Eli's formulation, which is, maybe the reason that private tzedakah is not coercible is because it doesn't need to be consequentialist, because there are other mechanisms in place, such as communal tzedakah, taxes, things like that. That's why it's justifiable to say that tzedakah is not consequentialist and therefore not coercible, right? Because there are other mechanisms. Now, what? It's a small nuance. Yeah. Okay, I thought we'd do this in two, but we ended up having a, I think, fruitful, broader discussion about the nature of ethics, which helped frame these positions, which I do think. In this particular case, I think they are really much, very much pushing at the... Right, this isn't just a Lumdish claim. You see that in their language, they're making, right, moral claims. Okay, we still didn't get to the Ritzbah, right? So for tomorrow, the Ritzbah is the third answer in Tosfos. Yes. We did 1, 2, and 4. No, no, I don't think so. I think it's Rabbeinu Tam, Ritzbari. No, I think we just went out of order. But whether it's third or fourth, okay, what's left is the Ritzba, whether he's third or fourth in Dozos, I'm... You're right, fourth. The final answer in Tosfot, the Ritzba. yeah, so what's left, therefore, is the Ritzba, right? The fourth answer. I stand corrected. The final answer in Tosfot. The Ritzba, if you look back at Rosh Hashanah that I was reading before, the Ritzba has a slightly different nuance on the Ritzba. So we have to do that tomorrow. That's the Ritzba based on the Yerushalmi, which we have not done. And the Ktzot, since you guys had trouble working through it, so tomorrow that may be all you do is work through the Ktzot. And we will see that there is a nuance, that there are nuances in the Ktzot that do touch on some of these things, but it is a slightly yeah, we'll see where the Ritzba falls. I think you could put the Ritzba the Ktzot in slightly different categories, but we'll see tomorrow. So tomorrow it's the Ritzba, the clarification of the Ritzba by the Ritzba and the Ktzot, and then we'll be finished with the Sugya. Okay, what?